and the weekend would be shot. By the same token, if Meredith was in the dark and Nora failed to alert her, she'd be setting herself up for recriminations. Why didn't you tell me? How could you have let me go on when you knew what was happening? Nora made sure the housekeeper, Mrs. Stumbo, readied the guest room, setting out fresh flowers, distilled water in a crystal carafe with matching glasses, and two sets of Egyptian cotton towels, folded together and tied with color-coordinated satin ribbon. Though it was April, evenings were still chilly, and she made sure all the fireplaces were laid with wood. Meals might be a problem. She and Channing had recently lost their personal chef, and Mrs. Stumbo couldn't be counted on to cook for the four of them. Nora checked the freezer, where she still had several dishes the chef had prepared before she left their employ, to pursue other goals. She'd actually jumped ship in order to work for another couple in Montebello, who'd offered $1,000 more a month. Nora had bid the chef a fond farewell and cut the couple from their social list. She decided she'd thaw the casserole of boeuf bourguignon and serve it that night with salad, French bread, and berries for dessert. Saturday night, she'd make reservations for the four of them for dinner at the country club. She wrote out a grocery list and sent Mrs. Stumbo off for items to cover breakfasts on Saturday and Sunday mornings and one lunch. Abner would insist on reciprocating their hospitality, taking them out for a meal on Sunday, and that would be that. The Lowes would be on their way back to Bel Air by 2 o'clock, and with luck, she and Channing would have Sunday evening to themselves. She'd hoped he'd arrive first so she could find out from him what, if anything, Meredith knew about Abner's latest fling. She wanted to be in the proper frame of mind so she could play her part. She also wanted to chide him for springing guests on her at the last minute, when he knew she'd been looking forward to time alone. She'd have to underplay any suggestion of criticism. If Channing started feeling defensive, he'd trot out that little boy pouting act of his. He had a knack for sounding pleasant when he was actually being chilly and withdrawn. As it turned out, the opportunity for conversation didn't present itself, because Channing and the Lowes arrived at the same time. First his car, then theirs, pulled into the courtyard. And from that point on, she had no chance to quiz him. Her irritation was quickly dispelled by cocktails and conversation. Who could hold on to a bad mood in the presence of expensive wine? Abner was at his most charming, a sure sign he was otherwise engaged. Meredith surely sensed what his behavior signified. Nora could tell Meredith yearned for more of the sympathy she had once lavished on her. Nora kept her manner light and saw to it that exchanges between the two of them were firmly anchored in the superficial. Twice, Meredith gave her hangdog, beseeching looks, and once seemed on the verge of speaking up, but Nora sailed on. Finally, when Channing and Abner were off making fresh drinks, Meredith touched Nora's arm and said in a woebegone tone, "We need to talk." "Sure. What's up?" "I don't even know where to start. Maybe we can do a beach walk in the morning, just the two of us. I really miss you." "Fine. Let's see what the guys have in mind, and maybe we can carve out some time," Nora said brightly. Inwardly, she felt a little stubborn streak kick in. She didn't relish the idea of an intimate chat with Meredith, and she would make sure it never happened. Really, it was time for Meredith to take responsibility for the bargain she'd made when she married the man. She was the reason Abner was unfaithful to his first wife, so what did she expect? She should suck it up or move on. Wallowing in misery was self-indulgent, especially when her woes were those she'd brought on herself. To Nora's great relief, the weekend had finally wound to a close without the much-dreaded beach walk. When Abner and Meredith pulled out of the driveway at 1, Nora finally felt herself relax. Unfortunately, the rest of Sunday was cut short by a call from the office that came in just after the Lowes left. Something had come up with one of Channing's celebrity clients, and he would have to dance attendance. No explanation or apology was needed because Nora understood. That was the nature of the beast. Channing was an entertainment lawyer, and his roster of clients included the up-and-coming talent along with the long-time players in the industry. He'd made a fortune on the basis of personal service. Like a doctor, he was ready to roll at any hour if the phone rang. Which meant that the personal matter she wanted to discuss was squeezed into the last few minutes of his visit when he was literally packing files in his briefcase and on his way to the car. What she'd wanted to clarify was the recent tiff she'd had with his personal assistant. Thelma, whose last name she had trouble remembering, had been with him 2 years. And while Nora had had trifling problems with her in the past, there was never any overt insubordination. She'd met Thelma when she first came to work for him. Nora made a point of putting in an appearance at the office whenever there was a new hire on board. That personal connection, even if it was only once, ensured a better phone relationship. Nora seldom called the office, but occasionally something came up about the house or his twin daughters. Channing's taste was consistent when it came to underlings. Secretaries, bookkeepers, administrative assistants, even housekeepers were cut from the same cloth. Women of a certain age who grew up during the Great Depression in an era of deprivation and want. These women were grateful to have well-paying jobs. They were schooled in old-fashioned values of hard work, loyalty, and thrift. His previous girl, Iris, had been with him for 7 years when she suffered a stroke that forced her into retirement. Thelma was the exception, some 20 years younger, plain, slightly overweight, and ever so faintly officious. Nora had talked to her on countless occasions since their first meeting, and there was never a suggestion of friendliness on the woman's part. To be fair, Channing did discourage chumminess. He'd often complained about his ex-wife, Gloria, who was forever befriending the hired help, becoming enmeshed in their personal upheavals. The cleaning lady, a drunk, had taken to calling Gloria in the middle of the night, asking for advances on her salary. The gardener had talked her into buying him new equipment when his was stolen from another job site. When the cook's daughter got pregnant, Gloria was the one driving the girl to her doctor's appointments because she was too sick to ride the bus. Channing thought it absurd that Gloria was at the beck and call of people on the payroll. With Nora, he'd put his foot down and she'd been happy to comply. She assumed he'd given Thelma the same stern talking to, which was why her tone of voice bordered on the chilly. Thelma, either unsure of herself or obsequious by nature, insisted on consulting Channing when Nora made even a minor request. Now, when Nora called the office to talk to him, she was greeted by a wall of cobwebs. Thelma was subtle about it, putting up a nearly imperceptible resistance that Nora couldn't call her on. If Nora asked her to cut a check, Thelma would sidestep until she could clear it with him. The second time it happened, Nora complained to Channing, and he'd said he'd speak to her. For a while, Thelma's attitude had improved, but then she'd reverted to the same sullen behavior, leaving Nora in the uncomfortable position of saying nothing or having to object yet again, which made her seem churlish. Thelma refused to recognize Nora's authority. Channing was her boss. Nora might be the boss's wife at home, but not where Thelma was concerned. Nora was ready to lower the boom. Channing, we really need to talk about Thelma.
We can do that later. Right now, I'm trying to get to this meeting before the situation blows up in my face, he said as he headed out the door. I'll see you Wednesday. Traffic probably won't be heavy. If you're in Malibu by 5 o'clock, I should give you plenty of time to get ready.
Nora stopped in her tracks.
For what? I'm not coming down at all this week.
What are you talking about? We have the fundraiser for the Alzheimer's Association.
A fundraiser? In the middle of the week? That's ridiculous.
The annual dinner dance. Don't play dumb, I told you last week.
Nora followed him down the front steps.
You never said a word.
He glanced back at her, irritation surfacing.
You're kidding me, right?
No, I'm not kidding. I have plans.
Well, cancel them. My presence is required, and I want you there. You begged off the last 6 events.
Pardon the hell out of me. I didn't realize we were keeping score.
Who said anything about keeping score? Name the last time you went any place with me.
Don't do that to me. You know I can never think of an example in the moment. The point is, Belinda's sister is coming into town from Houston. She's here 1 day, and we have tickets for the symphony that night. We had to pay a fortune for the seats.
Tell her we had plans, and it totally slipped your mind.
An Alzheimer's event, and it slipped my mind? How tacky is that?
Tell her anything you like. She can give your ticket to someone else.
I can't cancel at the last minute. It's inconsiderate. Besides, you know how much I hate those things.
This is not meant as entertainment. I bought a table for 10. We've gone every year without fail for the last 10.
And I'm always bored out of my mind.
You know what? I'm tired of your excuses. You pull this shit at the last minute, and it leaves me scrambling around trying to find someone to fill in. You know how embarrassing that is?
Oh, stop. You can go by yourself. It's not going to kill you for once.
Screw you, he said. He tossed his briefcase and a duffel in the trunk and then moved to the driver's side with Nora close behind. She was exasperated having to trot after him, which reduced their conversation to fits and starts. Channing slid in under the wheel and slammed the car door. He turned his key in the ignition so he could power down the window. You want to talk about Thelma? Fine. Let's talk about Thelma. She said you called on Friday asking her to cut you a check for $8,000. She said you were very frosty when she said it would have to go through me. She was worried she'd offended you.
Good. Perfect. She did offend me. That's what I wanted to talk to you about. You should have told me she controlled the purse strings. I have no idea.
Stop. You know better. Every expenditure gets funneled through her and then through me before it goes on to the accountant's office. With 17 attorneys in the firm, it's the only way I can keep track. She doesn't say yay or nay to anyone without checking with me first. That's just a fact.
Fine.
There's no reason for you to get all prickly about it. She's doing her job.
I don't want to discuss it.
That's unlike you. You're usually hell-bent on talking everything to death.
Why are you acting so put upon? It's a goddamn dinner dance in L.A. It's not the White House.
I told you twice.
No, you did not. You're bringing it up now because you're hoping to deflect the issue.
What issue? He said.
I don't see why I should have to justify myself to her.
You didn't offer an explanation. You told her to cut you a check. Is it too much to ask what you have in mind? Believe it or not, an $8,000 check isn't trivial.
I don't want to talk about it now.
And why is that?
6 months ago, I wanted to buy shares of IBM. You poo-pooed the idea, and the stock jumped 16 points in 2 days. If I'd had access to even a modest sum of money, I could have cleaned up.
And 2 days later, it tanked. You'd have lost it all.
I'd have sold before the price dropped and then bought it again at the new low. I'm not stupid about these things, whatever you might think.
What's this really about? Clearly, you've got your nose out of joint.
I wanted the $8,000 to buy shares of GE. Now it's too late. By the time the market closed on Friday, the stock had jumped from 82 to 106.
$8,000? What good would that have done?
That's irrelevant. I shouldn't have to beg.
There's no point in throwing a tantrum about good business practice. You want money? I'll set up an account for you.
You'll open an account for me? Like you're my father?
Channing's sigh was accompanied by a rolling of his eyes. High theater for him. He lowered his head, shaking it with resignation. The window slid up. He put the car in reverse and backed across the courtyard until he had the necessary clearance to pull out, which he did with a testy chirp of his tires. The next thing she knew, he was gone. She returned to the house and closed the door behind her. It wasn't the first time they'd clashed, and it certainly wouldn't be the last. The emotional uproar would fade and cooler heads would prevail, but she wasn't going to drop the matter. For the most part, they were capable of settling their differences, but she'd learned to avoid negotiations when one or the other of them was in high dudgeon. She went into the kitchen and cleared the counter of stray martini glasses, which she placed in the machine. She loved having the house to herself again. Monday morning, Mrs. Stumbo would do a thorough cleaning, changing sheets, doing 4 loads of laundry, and generally restoring order. For now, Nora was free to enjoy the quiet.
Briefly, she checked the guest room with its spacious adjoining bath, making sure the Lowes hadn't overlooked personal items. Nora didn't like other people's stray shampoo bottles accumulating in the shower, and there was always the chance someone had forgotten the odd piece of jewelry or a garment hanging in the closet. Meredith had left a copy of Los Angeles magazine on the bed table. Nora scooped it up, intending to toss it into the trash. Instead, she took it with her to the kitchen, where she made herself a cup of tea. She carried both teacup and magazine to the sunroom and sank into an upholstered chair. She put her feet up on the ottoman, grateful for the rare moment of relaxation. She leafed through glossy pages, checking the advertisements for shops on Rodeo Drive, expensive salons, art galleries, and boutique clothing stores. There was a 6-page spread on the mansion of the month, some overblown, though tastefully done palace built by one of the hot new movie producers. She also read the feature-length profile on an actress she'd met and disliked, taking a wicked satisfaction in the journalist's acid observations. What was meant to be a puff piece was devastatingly snide and unkind. When she reached the society section, she checked to see who'd been in attendance at various charity events. Channing was right about her begging off the last 6 occasions. She knew many of the couples who'd been photographed, usually paired with friends or linked with board members or celebrities, drinks in hand. The women were all decked out in full-length gowns and fabulous jewelry, posed side by side with their self-important husbands. The men did look elegant in their tuxedos, though the pictures, 2 inches by 2, were monotonously similar. The photographs represented the who's who of Hollywood society, with some couples in attendance at every event. She was secretly congratulating herself for ducking out on so many tedious evenings when she spotted a photograph of Channing with Abner and Meredith at the Denim and Diamonds Ball, which she'd also missed. The Lowes beamed as though blissfully happy. Now that was a laugh. She looked at the voluptuous redhead on Channing's arm. She didn't recognize the woman, but the dress she wore looked like a knockoff of the strapless white Gucci Nora kept at the house in Malibu. It couldn't be an original because she'd been assured hers was one of a kind. Briefly, she considered how awful it would have been if she'd showed up at the same party in a similar gown. She looked back at the redhead, alerted by the doting smile the woman was lavishing on Channing. It was the only photograph on the entire page where a woman was gazing at her companion instead of smiling directly at the camera. She read the caption and felt a silvery chill like a veil of mercury envelop her from head to toe. Thelma Landis. She had her hand tucked in the crook of Channing's arm. His right hand covered hers. Thelma was still overweight, but she'd managed to compress and confine every excess pound into a bloated approximation of the hourglass figure Marilyn Monroe had made famous 30 years before. Gone were Thelma's yellowing teeth and the drab, ill-cut hair. Now her gaudy, dyed red tresses were smoothed into a French roll. She wore diamond earrings, and the smile she flashed showed several $1,000 worth of snow-white caps. Nora felt the heat rise in her face as comprehension flooded her frame. She'd misunderstood. She'd misread the signs. Meredith hadn't sent her those beseeching looks in hopes of confiding her own marital misery. She'd pitied Nora for what she and half of Hollywood knew was going on between Channing and Thelma Landis, the fucking typist who worked for him. Chapter 6. Dante. Dante had taken up swimming for the second time in his life when he bought the estate in Montebello 18 years before. He was actually Lorenzo Dante Jr., commonly referred to as Dante to distinguish him from his father, Lorenzo Dante Sr. For security reasons, he avoided exercising in the open, which meant jogging, golf, and tennis were out. He'd set up a home gym where he lifted weights 3 times a week. For cardio, he swam laps. The 32-acre property was surrounded by a stone wall, with entrance effected through electric gates, one set at the front and a second set at the rear. each with its own small stone guardhouse complete with a uniformed armed guard. There were 6 men altogether working 8-hour shifts. A 7th oversaw the security cameras, which were monitored in situ by day and remotely by night. There were 5 buildings on the compound. The 2-story main house had a detached 5-car garage with 2 apartments above. Tommaso, Dante's chauffeur, lived in 1, and the other was occupied by his personal chef, Sophie. There were also a 2-bedroom guest house and a pool house, which included Dante's home gym and a 12-seat theater. Dante's home office was in a sprawling bungalow referred to as the cottage, which had its own living room, bedroom, 1.5 baths, and a modest kitchen. He also had a suite of offices in downtown Santa Teresa, where he spent the better part of his workday. The cottage and the pool house appeared to be separate from the main house, but were actually connected by tunnels that branched off in 2 directions under the tennis court. Dante had added the indoor lap pool across the back of the main house, 2 lanes wide and 25 yards long, with a retractable roof. The bottom and sides were lined with iridescent glass tiles, and when the sun shone overhead, it was like moving through a shimmering rainbow of light. His mother had taught him to swim when he was 4 years old. She'd been fearful of the water as a child, and she made certain her own children were skilled swimmers from an early age. Dante did 25 laps a day, starting at 5:30 in the morning, counting backward from 25 to 0. He kept the water temperature 70 degrees, the surrounding air at 84. He loved the way sound was muffled by the water, loved the simplicity of the crawl stroke, loved how clean and empty he felt when he was done. He and Lola, his girlfriend of 8 years, had returned the night before from a ski trip to Lake Louise, where a fluke in temperatures made the runs almost too sloppy to ski. He hated cold weather anyway, and if it had been up to him, he'd have cut the trip short. But Lola was adamant and wouldn't even entertain the idea. He found vacations stressful. He didn't like to be idle, and he didn't like being separated from his business dealings. He was looking forward to getting back in the swing of things. At 7 that Monday morning, he showered and dressed. He could smell coffee, bacon, and something sugar-scented. He looked forward to eating in solitude, catching up on the news while he lingered over his meal. Before he went down to breakfast, he stopped by his father's quarters on the 2nd floor. The door was open, and the nurse was in the process of changing his sheets. She told him his father had had a rough night and had finally abandoned any hope of sleep. He'd put on his suit and had Tommaso take him into the office in Santa Teresa. Most days, the old man sat at his desk for hours, drinking coffee, reading biographies of long-dead political greats, and working the New York Times crossword puzzle until it was time to go home. Dante went down to the basement level and took the tunnel from the main house to the cottage. Coming up from below, he crossed a short stretch of lawn to the guest house to pay his morning visit to his Uncle Alfredo, who'd been living there since he was discharged from the hospital after cancer surgery the year before. Originally, the guest house had been set up to accommodate a series of nannies who worked for the previous owner. Now, one of the 2 bedrooms was outfitted with a hospital bed, and the 2nd bedroom was available for the night nurses. A nurse's aide came in days to help with his care. Alfredo was his father's sole surviving brother and virtually penniless. 2 younger brothers, Donatello and Amo, at ages 19 and 22, had died the same day, February 7th, 1943, 2 days before the Battle of Guadalcanal came to an end. Dante couldn't figure out what had happened to Pop and his uncle Alfredo. How could you reach the end of your life and have nothing to show for it? Pop claimed it was bad financial advice from an accountant who was no longer with the firm, meaning 6 feet under. Dante suspected what his father referred to as bad financial advice was really the function of his living perpetually beyond his means. Lorenzo Sr. was a local boy who'd risen to prominence during Prohibition, smart enough to cash in on the boom. The market was wide open with a premium placed on rot-gut liquor. Gambling and prostitution seemed to flourish in the same spirit of excess. He never regarded the major syndicate mobsters as his allies. New York, Detroit, Chicago, Kansas City, and Las Vegas seemed remote. He was distantly related to many of the players, but his ambitions were strictly provincial, and Santa Teresa was the perfect small community for promoting the sin trades. His organization became a feeder to San Francisco and Los Angeles. Beyond those two cities, he had little interest. He didn't interfere with the big boys, and they didn't interfere with him. He had an open-door policy, offering safe haven for any made man who needed to lay low for a while. He also entertained his Midwest and East Coast cronies with a generous hand. The West Coast was already a magnet to rich and restless citizens who came from every part of the country, looking for sunshine, relaxation, and sheltered surroundings in which to indulge their low appetites. For 6 decades, Lorenzo Sr. had enjoyed his status. Now he was treated with all the deference due a man who'd once wielded power but wielded it no more. Times had changed. The same money could be made from the same sordid activities, but with a firewall of paid protection. The legal profession and big business now provided all the cover that was needed, and life went on as before. Control had passed to his oldest son, Dante, who'd worked for years papering over the cracks with a veneer of respectability. Lorenzo had taken for granted he'd die young, and therefore had no need to provide for himself in his old age. Alfredo was the same way, so maybe it was something they'd learned in their youth. Whatever the source of their poor decisions, they now lived on Dante's dime. He also supported his brother, Cappy, who was supposedly getting on his feet after an early release on a 5-year bid at Soledad. 3 of Dante's 4 sisters were spread out across the country, married to men who did well, thank God, with 12 children among them, democratically distributed at 3 apiece. Elena lived in Sparta, New Jersey, Gina in Chicago, and Mia in Denver. His favorite sister, Talia, widowed 2 years before, had moved back to Santa Teresa. Her 2 sons, now 22 and 25, were college graduates with good jobs. Her youngest, a daughter, was attending Santa Teresa City College and living at home. Talia was the only one of his sisters he talked to with any regularity. Her husband had left her megabucks, and she didn't look to Dante for financial support, which was a blessing. As it was, he had 12 full-time and 5 part-time employees at the house. Dante tapped on Uncle Alfredo's door, and the nurse admitted him. Cara had worked the morning shift, making sure the old man was clean, freshly dressed, and had taken his daily regimen of medications. Alfredo was in pain much of the time, but there were moments when he was able to sit out on the patio, surrounded by the roses Dante had planted for him when he first arrived. That's where Dante found him now, his white hair still damp from his sponge bath. He had a shawl pulled over his shoulders, and he had his eyes closed, enjoying the early morning sunshine. Dante pulled up a chair, and Alfredo acknowledged him without bothering to look. "How was Canada?" Dante said. "Boring. Too warm to ski, too cold to do anything else. 2 days in, my knees were killing me. Lola claimed it was psychosomatic, so I got no sympathy. She said I was just looking for an excuse to go home. How are you?" His uncle managed a half-smile. "Not wonderful. Mornings are tough. It'll get better as the day goes on." "With enough pills," he said. "Yesterday, Father Ignatius came to the house and heard my confession. First time in 45 years, so it took a while." "Must have been a relief." "Not as much as I'd hoped." "Any regrets?" "Everybody has regrets. Things you did, you shouldn't have. Things you didn't do, you should have. Hard to know which is worse." Dante said, "Maybe in the end, it doesn't matter." "Believe me, it matters. Tell yourself it doesn't, but it does. I repented my sins, but that don't repair the damage. At least you had a chance to come clean." Alfredo shrugged. "I wasn't entirely candid. Close as I am to leaving this earth,
There are some secrets I'm reluctant to give up. It's a burden on my soul. You still have time. Don't I wish, he said mildly. How's Cappy doing? That fuck's got more ambition than brains. Alfredo smiled and closed his eyes. So use that to your advantage. You know Sun Tzu, the art of war? I do not. He says what? To secure ourselves against defeat lies in our own hands. But the opportunity of defeating the enemy is provided by the enemy himself. You understand what I'm saying? Dante studied his uncle's face. I'll give it some thought. You better do more than that. Uncle Alfredo fell silent. Dante watched the rise and fall of his chest, shoulders now spindly, arms as white as bone. His knuckles were red and swollen, and Dante imagined they'd be hot to the touch. A gentle snoring began, which at least signaled that the old man was alive, if not attentive. He admired Alfredo's stoicism. The fight was wearing him down, the pain grinding away at him. But he didn't complain. Dante had no use for people who whined and bellyached, an attitude he'd learned from Pop, who wouldn't tolerate complaints from him or from anyone else. Dante had lived his life listening to his father's admonitions about people whom he considered weak and stupid and conniving. Dante was the eldest of six. Cappy was the youngest, with the four girls between them. After his mother had walked out, Lorenzo had taken to beating Dante with a savagery that was unrelenting. Dante took the punches, thinking to protect his little brother. He knew Lorenzo would never lay a hand on the girls. Between the ages of 12 and 14, Cappy was subject to the same abuse. But then something changed. Cappy began to fight back, refusing to take the old man's crap. For a brief period, the violence escalated, and then suddenly, Lorenzo backed off. Whatever the strange dynamic between them, Cappy had ended up just like Pop, careless, mean, and impulsive. The dining room was empty when Dante sat down. Sophie had laid out the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times, and the local paper that Dante occasionally scanned for gossip. Lola wouldn't be joining him. She'd used jet lag as today's excuse for sleeping in. Lola was a night owl, staying up until all hours watching TV, old black-and-white movies shown nightly on an off-channel. Most days she wouldn't emerge from the master suite until early afternoon. One day a week she went into the office and made a show of being useful. He'd put her on the payroll and he insisted she do something to earn her keep. She was the first woman who'd been in his life longer than a year. He'd always been wary of women. He made a point of keeping his distance, which most women found intriguing at first, then infuriating, and finally intolerable. Women wanted a relationship that was concrete and clearly defined. The commitment talk would begin after the first few months and accelerate until he shut it down and the women moved on. He never had to break up with them. They broke up with him, which suited him just fine. It had been pointed out to him more than once that he was attracted to the same type over and over. Young, dark-haired, dark-eyed, and thin. In effect, his mother at 33 when she'd left without a word. Lola was different, or so it seemed. They'd met in a bar on her 28th birthday. He'd stopped in for a drink, bringing his usual contingent, chauffeur, bodyguard, and a couple of pals. He'd noticed her the minute he walked in. She was there celebrating with friends, in the midst of a champagne toast when he sat down at the next table. Dark mane of hair, dark eyes, a voluptuous mouth. She was long-limbed and rail-thin, in tight jeans and a T-shirt through which he could see the shape of her small breasts. She'd spotted him about the same time, and the two had played eye tag for an hour before she walked over and introduced herself. He'd taken her back to his place, thinking to impress her. Instead, she'd been amused. He learned later that her tablemates had warned her about him, for all the good it did. Lola was attracted to bad boys. Until she met Dante, she'd spent years bailing guys out of jail. believing their promises, waiting for them to change. Lola stuck with them through their prison sentences and stints in rehab. Her faith in them rendered her only more gullible in the face of the next unlucky loser. Dante was clean by comparison. He made big money and he was generous. He offered her the same whiff of danger, but he was smarter and better insulated. Lola teased him about his armor-plated limousine and his bodyguards. He liked her sassiness, the fact that she'd sooner flip him off than do his bidding. After the first 6 years, talk of marriage began to filter into her conversation. She was impatient with the status quo. Dante had sidestepped the issue, holding her off for another 2 years, but he could feel himself weakening. What difference would it make? They'd been living as husband and wife since the beginning of the relationship. To date, his argument had been that a marriage license was superfluous. Why insist on a piece of paper when she already enjoyed all the perks and benefits? Lately, she'd been turning it around on him, pointing out that if marriage meant so little, why was he making such a big deal of it? At 9, he pushed the newspapers aside and finished his coffee. Before walking out of the kitchen, he buzzed Tommaso on the intercom. "Would you bring the car around? I'm waiting at the side door. Hubert's riding shotgun." "Just what I like to hear." As Dante passed through the sheltered portico off the library, Tommaso opened the back door of the stretch limousine and watched him slide into the back seat. Drive time to the office would be 15 minutes, even as Tommaso varied the routes. Hubert, Dante's hulking bodyguard, shifted in the front seat and nodded a greeting. Hubert was Czechoslovakian and spoke very little English. He was good at what he did, and his minimal comprehension meant he couldn't eavesdrop when Dante and Tommaso discussed business. At 6'5", weighing the better part of 300 pounds, Hubert had a presence that was reassuring to his employers, like owning a Rottweiler with a placid disposition and vicious territorial instincts. Dante noticed Tommaso eyeing him in the rearview mirror. "What's up?" he asked. Tommaso said, "I thought you'd be windburned." "Hardly left the hotel. Next time I talk vacations, remind me how much I hate being away." "Resort was okay? For $2,000 a night, it was so-so." "How about the guys we hired to look after you?" "Not as competent as you two, but I'm alive and well." Tommaso was quiet for the duration of the drive. He pulled into the underground parking garage that ran beneath the Passage's shopping plaza on the Macy's end of the mall. Hubert emerged from the car and did a quick scan, searching the nearly empty space for potential danger before he opened the back door and Dante got out. Tommaso lowered the window.
"Hey, boss, you might want to check with Mr. Abramson before you do anything else."
Dante paused, leaning down to peer into the driver's side window.
"And why is that?"
"All I know is he said you should talk to him soon as you got in. He's not one to run off at the mouth, but his body language was on the urgent side of tense."
"You know what it's about?"
"Better you should hear it from him. Killing the messenger being what it is. What time you want to be picked up?"
"I'll call.
You can take Pop back to the house whenever he's ready to go. Might be a long day for me, depending on what went down while I was gone." Tommaso seemed on the verge of saying more, but Dante didn't like to linger in the open. So with Hubert close on his heels, he crossed to the elevators and pushed the up button. The two of them took the elevator to the top floor. Once Dante left the elevator, Hubert returned to the car. Passing through the reception area, Dante noticed a slim brunette ensconced in one of the big leather chairs, leafing through a magazine. He paused at the receptionist's desk.
"Morning, Abby. Is Saul in?"
"No, sir. Mr. Abramson had a dental appointment. He should be back by 10.
"Tell him I want him in my office," he said, and then flicked a look at the visitor. "Who's she?"
"Mrs. Vogelsang. Mr. Berman referred her."
"Give me 5 minutes and then you can show her in."
On his way down the corridor, he tapped on his father's office door and stuck his head in. Lorenzo, fully dressed in a three-piece suit and black wingtips, was stretched out on the couch asleep, a biography of Winston Churchill open face down across his chest. Dante eased the door shut,
and left him to his rest. He sat down at his desk and put in a call to Maurice Berman, who owned a small chain of high-end jewelry stores. When Berman picked up, Dante said, "Hey, Maurice, Dante, I got a gorgeous woman waiting in reception. What's the story?" "Channing Vogelsang's wife. You know the name?" "I don't." "Hotshot Hollywood attorney. They have a house in Malibu and a second home in Montebello. They split time between the two. I bought a couple of pieces from her. Nice, high quality, and the price was fair. Then she shows me a ring I have problems with. I'm thinking, who am I to bring bad tidings to a beautiful woman? Money she's asking, it was out of my league anyway. I told her you were the only guy in town with the resources to take it off her hands. What'd she need the money for? Beats me. She's a cool customer. Not a lot of small talk and no explanation. Drugs? I doubt it. Could be gambling, but she doesn't look like the type. I handed her a check for 7 on jewelry appraised at 42. Nobody ever said you weren't generous, Dante said. Tell me about the pieces you bought. A pair of cabochon, sapphire, and diamond earrings, probably worth 17 grand, and an Art Deco sapphire and diamond lined bracelet worth 25 easy. The ring, I don't like. I'm willing to take a look. I thought you'd see it that way. Let me know what comes of it. Dante hung up and buzzed Abby, asking her to bring in Mrs. Vogelsang. He crossed to the door and watched the two approach. When Abby showed her into the office, he held out his hand. "Mrs. Vogelsang, a pleasure. I'm Lorenzo Dante. My father's Lorenzo Sr., so I'm Dante to most. Come in and have a seat." "It's Nora," she replied, and the two shook hands. Her fingers were cool and slim, her grip strong. Her smile was tentative, and he realized she was ill at ease. "Coffee?" he asked. "Yes, please. I'd like milk if you have it, no sugar." "Make that too," he said to Abby. While she went off to the break room, Dante gestured toward a leather-upholstered chair that was part of a seating arrangement in front of the 3 big circular windows that looked out on the state. She sat down, placing a large, expensive-looking black leather handbag on the floor next to her. She was trim, petite, in a well-cut black suit that suggested more than it revealed. A delicate scent trailed into the room after her. He settled on the couch, trying not to stare. She was so beautiful, he could hardly take his eyes off her. There was an elegance about her, a reserve he found unsettling. He manufactured small talk while they waited for the coffee, happy to have an excuse to study her at close range. Solemn, dark eyes. Sweet mouth. Her gaze traveled across the room, which was awash in tones of gray. The upholstered pieces were covered in ultra suede in a deep charcoal shade. The rug, a softer gray. The walls, paneled in whitewashed walnut. She turned a curious gaze on him. "May I ask what you do? I assumed you dealt in estate jewelry. This looks like an attorney's office." "I'm a private banker of sorts. I lend money to clients who don't qualify for loans from traditional institutions. Most prefer to keep their finances out of the public eye. I also own a number of commercial businesses. What about you?"
"My husband's a lawyer in the industry."
"The industry meaning the film business. So I've heard. Channing Vogelsang. You live in Los Angeles?"
"Malibu. We have a second home in Montebello."
"Nice. You belong to the Montebello Country Club?"
"Nine Palms," she said, correcting him.
"Maybe you know the Hellers, Robert and his wife."
"Gretchen, yes. They're good friends. As a matter of fact, we're meeting for dinner at the club next Saturday."
"How do you know them?" "Robert and I had business dealings in times past," Dante said. "It's possible I'll see you there."
"At the club?"
"You don't have to sound so surprised. You're not the only one with friends," he said. "At any rate, I talked to Maurice Berman this morning. He says you have a ring you'd like to sell. May I see it?"
"Certainly."
She reached into her bag and took out a ring box, which she handed him. He opened the box and found himself looking at a radiant-cut pink diamond, flanked by 2 white diamonds. 5 carats? 5.46. The setting is platinum and 18-karat gold. The smaller stones total 1.7 carats. My husband bought it from a New York dealer several months ago.
You know what he paid?
$125,000.
You have the bill of sale?
I don't have access to it. My husband keeps financial records at the office.
Dante let that pass, wondering if Channing Vogelsang knew what she was up to. You mind if I get an outside opinion? I've got a gal in the office who's a trained gemologist.
If you like.
Abby returned with a tray that held a coffee carafe, two cups and saucers, spoons, and a creamer and a sugar bowl. She placed the tray on the glass-topped coffee table and passed Nora a saucer and cup. Abby filled hers, being careful not to get the steaming liquid too close to the rim. Nora helped herself to milk from the pitcher while Abby poured coffee for Dante. Before she left, Dante held out the ring box.
Give this to Luell and have her take a look.
Yes, sir.
Abby left the office with the ring box and closed the door behind her.
This shouldn't take long, he said.
There was silence while she sipped her coffee. He set his cup aside untouched.
You mind if I ask a few questions?
She tilted her head in a move that he took as assent.
The ring was a gift from your husband?
Yes.
I'm guessing an anniversary?
10th? 14th. Why do you ask?
I'm trying to understand what's happening here.
Nothing complicated, she said. I'd prefer the cash.
And for this, you'd go behind his back?
I'm not going behind his back.
He lifted one brow.
So he knows you're doing this?
I don't see that it's any of your business.
I'm not trying to be fresh. I'm confused. I thought marriage was about having someone you rely on. Someone you can say anything you want to. No secrets and no holding back. Otherwise, what's the point?
This has nothing to do with him. The ring is mine.
He won't notice you're not wearing it.
He knows I don't care for it. It's not my style.
How much are you asking?
75.
Dante watched her face, which was more expressive than she knew.
In her life, for some reason, the stakes had gone up.
He waited, but she didn't expand.
I'm surprised you're willing to part with it. No sentiment attached?
I'm not comfortable discussing it.
He smiled.
You want 75 grand and it's not worth a conversation?
I didn't mean it that way. It's personal.
He watched her with interest, amused at her refusing to meet his eyes.
Must be very personal to have you salting money away.
Startled, her gaze came up to his.
What makes you think I'm doing that?
Because you sold two other pieces of jewelry. Nothing as pricey as this, from what Maurice says.
I had no idea he'd discuss it with you. I consider that indiscreet.
What, you think there's a confidentiality clause in a deal like this?
Business is business.
I figure you're stockpiling cash, and I'm curious.
She hesitated, not meeting his eyes.
Call it insurance.
Mad money?
If you like.
Fair enough, he said.
Dante's phone rang. He reached over to the end table and picked up the handset, saying,
Yes, ma'am?
Luell said,
Can I see you in my office?
Sure thing, he said, and hung up.
To Nora, he said,
Would you excuse me? This should only take a minute.
Of course.
He closed the door behind him and proceeded to Luell's office in the same corridor. She'd been the company controller for the past 15 years. He found her sitting at her desk, the ring box open in one hand. She held it up.
What's the story?
Lady in my office is selling it.
How much?
75. She tells me her husband bought it from a New York dealer for 125. No bill of sale, but she seems sincere.
Guess again.
It's bullshit. The diamond's flawed. It's been subjected to a process called clarity enhancement, in which a resin-like material is used to correct imperfections. If he paid 125, he was robbed.
Maybe he didn't know.
Or maybe he paid less and lied to her.
The color's bullshit, too. The diamond probably didn't score well, so it's been irradiated, which gives it the pink tint. We're still talking 5.46 carats.
I didn't say it was junk. I said it wasn't worth 75.
He smiled. How much did I pay for your training?
She handed him the ring box.
$19,000 for the certification as a gemologist, with an additional $13,000 for certification in colored stones.
Money well spent.
At the time, you complained.
Shame on me.
That's what I said. He put the box in his suit coat pocket and patted the bulge.
Remind me, and I'll give you a bonus at the end of the year.
I'd rather have it now.
Done, Dante said.
Give Maurice Berman a call and tell him what you told me.
When he got back to his office, Nora was standing at one of the circular windows, watching the pedestrians passing on the far side of the street.
Good for spying purposes, he said.
Glass looks opaque from the outside, smoke black.
I've seen the windows from the street.
Odd to be seeing them from this side.
She smiled briefly and returned to her seat.
Is everything okay?
It's fine. This was another matter altogether. Nothing to do with you.
He stopped at his desk and removed a big padded mailer from the bottom drawer, and then crossed to the side wall and triggered the panel that concealed his office safe. He shielded the contents of the safe from view while he removed 7 thick bundles of $100 bills bound in packets. He added one smaller bundle and placed all 8 in the mailer. He returned to his seat before he gave it to her. She opened the mailer and glanced at the contents. She seemed startled, and the color rose in her cheeks.
75, he said. It's all there.
I expected a wire transfer, maybe you'd pay by check.
You don't want 75 grand showing up in your bank account. A deposit that size generates a report to the IRS.
Is that a problem?
I don't want to create a paper trail that starts with me and ends up with you. I'm under investigation. The IRS finds out you've done business with me, they'll beat a path to your door. You don't want our association coming to light.
There's nothing illegal about selling a ring.
Unless you sell it to a guy the feds are hot to prosecute.
For what? You said you were a private banker.
A private banker of sorts.
She stared at him. You're a loan shark.
Among other things.
She held up the bulky mailer. Where did this come from?
I told you, I operate a number of businesses that generate cash. I'm passing some of it on to you.
That's why you didn't haggle. I said 75, and you never batted an eye. You're laundering money.
It's only laundering if dirty money's been integrated and it comes out clean.
All you have to do is hang on to it. That's ridiculous. What good's the cash if I can't use it?
Who said you couldn't use it?
Stash it in a safe deposit box and move it into a checking or savings account in increments of less than 10 grand. It's no big deal.
I can't do that. Why not? I have the ring, you have the cash. As long as you don't call attention to it, we both benefit. The point is, it's yours.
I'm not that desperate.
I think you are. I don't know what's happened in your life, but your husband's a fool if he's giving you grief.
That's no concern of yours.
Nora rose from her chair and retrieved her handbag. Dante stood up at the same time. She pushed the padded mailer toward him. He held up his hands, refusing to accept the package.
Why don't you think about it overnight?
I don't need to think about it, she said, and tossed the mailer onto the chair. There was a brief knock at the door, and Abby appeared.
Mr. Abramson is here.
Nora said, I'll let you get back to work. Dante took the ring box from his pocket and placed it in her palm.
Change your mind. Let me know.
Nora broke off eye contact, saying nothing as she left the room. Dante watched her depart, hoping she'd look back at him, which she refused to do. Abby remained in the room. Dante looked at her.
Something else?
I just wanted to remind you I'll be out of town Thursday and Friday of this week.
I'll be back at work next Monday.
Fine. Enjoy yourself. Once she was gone, he returned to his desk and settled into his chair. Abramson came in and closed the door. He'd been in partnership with Dante for 20 years, and he was one of the few men Dante trusted. He was in his 50s, balding,
with a long, solemn face and glasses with dark frames. He was tall and trim in a custom-made suit. He'd apparently had Novocaine on the left side of his mouth, and it hadn't worn off. There was a puffiness and a droop to his lip on that side, as though he'd suffered a stroke. He said, "Audrey's dead." No preamble. It took Dante half a beat to shift his focus from Nora to Abramson.
Shit. When was this?
Sunday.
Yesterday? How?
She got picked up for shoplifting. This was Nordstrom's, Friday afternoon. I guess she couldn't talk her way out of it, so she was thrown in the clink. Her boyfriend put up bail, but by then she was hysterical. Word reached Cappy she was close to cutting a deal. So he and the boys took her up to Cold Spring Bridge and tossed her over the rail.
Fuck!
I've been telling you for months the kid is out of control. He's reckless and dumb, and it's a dangerous combination. I think he's leaking information to the cops.
I'm too old for this shit, Dante said. I can't have him whacked. I know it needs doing, but I can't. Maybe once upon a time, but not now. I'm sorry.
Your call. But you buy into the consequences. That's all I'm saying. Chapter 7 Monday morning, I dragged my sorry butt out of bed at 6 o'clock. Assembled myself, and went out for my jog. I wasn't limping, but I was conscious of my bruised shin, which, the last time I peeked, was as dark and ominous as a thundercloud. My palm had scabbed over, but I'd be picking grit out of the wound for days. On the plus side, the sun was up and the April sky above was bright blue. There was talk of a storm coming in, a phenomenon known as the Pineapple Express, a system that rotates in from the South Pacific, picking up tropical moisture as it moves toward the coast. Any rain would be warm and the air would be balmy, my concept of spring in the south. We weren't yet feeling the effects except for the ragged rim of clouds piled up on the horizon, like trash against a fence. Jogging was a chore, but I chugged on, feeling leaden to the bone, probably due to the change in barometric pressure. These are the days that require discipline. When exercise is pure duty and the good feeling only comes later, consisting solely of self-congratulations for having done the job at all. I walked the final block home. I had barely broken a sweat, but my body temperature was dropping rapidly and I was cold. I reached the front gate and when I bent to pick up the morning paper, I experienced a whisper of depression. Henry's copy of the Dispatch was usually lying on the sidewalk next to mine. He'd canceled for the duration of his out-of-town stay, leaving my paper all alone and looking forlorn. Amazing the things I miss about the man when he's gone. I let myself into my studio and put on a pot of coffee, then went up the spiral stairs to the loft. Once I'd showered and dressed, I trotted down again, spirits on the rise. I leafed through the paper until I found the obituaries and then flapped the section open and folded the pages back. I poured myself a bowl of cereal and added milk, spooning up breakfast while I read. I can't remember when the daily death list became a matter of such interest. Usually the names mean little or nothing. In a town of 85,000, the chances of being acquainted with the newly departed aren't that great. I scanned for ages and birth years, checking to see where mine falls in relation to the deceased. If the dead are my age or younger, I read the notices with close attention to circumstances. Those are the deaths I ponder, reminded every morning that life is fragile and not as much in our control as we'd like to think. Personally, I don't endorse the notion of mortality. It's fine for other folk, but I disapprove of the concept for me and my loved ones. Seems unfair that we're not allowed to vote on the matter, and not one of us is excused. Who made up that rule? I'd scarcely opened that section when I spotted a photograph in the middle of the page and found myself staring at the shoplifter I'd observed Friday afternoon. I drew back, looked again, and then read once quickly to get the gist. Audrey Vance, 63, had passed away unexpectedly the day before, Sunday, April 24th. The mid-60s age range was about where I'd placed the woman. The likeness was unmistakable.
How odd was that? I skipped to the last line, which suggested in lieu of flowers, donations should be made to the American Heart Association in Audrey's name. The notice was short and on the stingy side. I went back to the beginning and read again with care. Audrey was described as vivacious and fun-loving, admired by all who knew her. Not a word about her parents, her education, her hobbies, or good deeds. Her survivors included a son, Don, of San Francisco, and a daughter, Elizabeth, also living in San Francisco. There were numerous unnamed nieces and nephews left to mourn her passing. In addition, she would be greatly missed by her fiancé and loving companion, Marvin Stryker. The visitation was at Winnington Blake Mortuary, Tuesday, 10 to noon, with a service to follow at 2 at Winnington Blake. There was no mention of the burial. I could hardly take it in. I wondered if the trauma of her arrest had triggered her collapse. It was not beyond the realm of possibility. Audrey had looked matronly and middle class, not out of place in an upscale department store. Until I saw her shoplift, I'd have pegged her as the type who returned her library books on time and wouldn't have dreamed of fudging on her income tax forms. What a shock she must have experienced when the loss prevention officer caught up with her. She'd made it as far as the mall and must have thought she was in the clear, even with the store alarm bleating behind her. From what Claudia had said about her weeping and wailing, she was either a first-rate actress or truly desperate. Sincerity aside, she must have felt humiliated being hauled off in handcuffs. I was thrown in jail once myself, and I can tell you, it's not an experience you want to repeat. Habitual criminals are probably undismayed by the booking process, associating as they do with other miscreants for whom pat-downs and strip searches are the norm. All they care about is finding a bail bondsman as fast as possible so they can fork over the 10% and get themselves cut loose. Poor Audrey Vance. What a strange turn of events. I wondered how much, if anything, her fiancé knew about her ordeal. Following on the heels of my initial surprise, I experienced a twinge of guilt. I'd been thrilled to hear about her arrest, happy to know she was being called to account. The idea that she'd been slapped with consequences suited me just fine. We're each responsible for our own choices, and if she'd elected to break the law, why should she have been spared? At the same time, as much as I'd rejoiced at her comeuppance, I hadn't expected her to die. In this country, at least as far as I know, shoplifting isn't deemed a capital offense. I didn't imagine wielding such influence in the universe that my very enmity had pushed her into the grave. Where I faulted myself was in my sense of moral superiority. Idly, I wondered if she'd been charged with a felony or a misdemeanor. The 2 pairs of pajamas at full price, including tax, would have pushed her over the $400 limit, shifting her offense from petty to grand theft. But what about the sale? Was she more or less culpable in the eyes of the law? At 75% off, was a felony discounted down to a lesser charge? In either case, the poor woman was dead, and that seemed bizarre. Maybe she'd suffered from a chronic medical condition that left her vulnerable to stress. Or maybe she'd experienced chest pains and, like so many women, had decided to say nothing because she didn't want to make a fuss. Even if she was under a doctor's care, death might have come as a surprise. She might have appeared to be in perfect health, asymptomatic, and still toppled over dead with little apparent provocation. I'd been a witness, standing by in the final days of her life, with no idea how little time she had left. It was freakish to contemplate, and I could hardly get it out of my mind. I grabbed my jacket and car keys, taking the paper with me. I drove to the office in hopes of distracting myself with the business of doing business. Once at my desk, I caught up with my paperwork. I was doing okay until the telephone rang. Milhone Investigations. Kinsey? A woman's voice. Yes, ma'am. This is Claudia Rhines. Did you see the article in this morning's paper? I put an automatic hand against my heart. I did, and I feel like such a turd. What are the odds of a heart attack? Jesus! I wonder if she knew what was happening to her.
There was a moment of quiet. You didn't see the article.
I did, too. Audrey Vance, 63 years old, 2 grown kids, and she was engaged to some guy. I have the newspaper right here.
Fine. But she didn't die of a heart attack. She jumped off